Hello, Current Affairs listeners. This is contributing editor Eli Massey, and we have a very special episode for you today. I am joined by Cenk Uygur. He is the founder and host of the progressive network TYT and the show The Young Turks. He is running for Congress in California's 25th congressional district, or formerly held by Katie Hill. You have been endorsed by progressive Congressman Ro Khanna, as well as national co-chair of Bernie Sanders' campaign and Ohio State Senator Nina Turner. Thanks so much for joining us, Cenk.
No problem, Eli. I appreciate it. I also just got an endorsement from Our Revolution in the Antelope Valley, which is about half my district.
Okay, that's very exciting. Well, we're delighted to have you on the podcast. Let's start just very simply with why you're running and your background.
Yeah, absolutely. And those are very related. So I started doing the Young Turks about 17, almost 18 years ago now. Young progressives looking to overthrow an established system. That's the dictionary definition. And that's what we do. So we've backed a lot of progressive candidates throughout the years. But really what we do is the news. And in terms of the news, we do the facts first. Then we do context. And then we do perspective. So we are not at all shy about our perspective. In fact, we call Young Turks the home of progressives. And so we started out in my living room with almost no money. And back in 2002, we now have 12 billion lifetime views and about 50 million unique viewers a month. And that is because we gave people something that they desperately wanted and nobody else was giving them, which is a strong progressive voice. And in the meanwhile, I started two different political organizations. One is called Wolfpack. That's to get an amendment to get all money out of politics, because if we don't fix that, we can't fix any of the other issues, which will relate to my campaign in a second. And then I, after Trump won in 2016, on that night, actually, I wasn't sad. I was mad. And I couldn't believe that the Democratic Party, in its infinite incompetence, had lost an unlosable election to a total buffoon, let alone a monster. So I co-founded a group called Justice Democrats, that is a wing of the Democratic Party. It famously found and helped to run Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. We also backed Rashida Tlaib, Ilhan Omar, Ayanna Pressley. Other incumbents are Ro Khanna, Pramila Jayapal, and Raul Grijalva. So we have begun to board the aircraft carrier of the Democratic Party, and we are going to take it over and make it the Progressive Party again. So as I was doing all of that, the one thing that I was frustrated by is that even among our wonderful allies, no one was calling money in politics what it is, which is bribery. When ExxonMobil gives you money, that is not for charity. That is to absolutely positively to make sure that they bribe you. And when they give you a second contribution, that means they got a return on investment. And if we're never going to solve the massive issues in our politics unless we call out that bribery, not just in the Republican Party, but in the Democratic Party. And so that's why I jumped into the 25th district race. And it's a perfect district. It's working class. It's purple. And it's also beautiful. And so I think this is potentially a race that will define the Democratic Party. My opponent is the most establishment candidate you'll ever see. It's almost Hillary Clinton versus Bernie 2.0. So the battle's in the 25th, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Okay. Now, Katie Hill, who previously held the seat but was forced to resign in a rather demeaning and cruel kind of way, endorsed your primary opponent, Christy Smith. You're a man. Christy Smith is a woman. You've sort of hinted at, started talking about the differences between you and Christy Smith, but maybe you could elaborate a bit further. What do you bring to the table that your opponents do not?
I bring fire and fury, and I'm an actual progressive. So those are two huge differences. So let's take the issue that you're talking about, gender. Okay. First of all, I back Katie Hill 100% during that controversy. Now, there's things that we might not yet know, but from what's in the public record, who cares about the pictures? Are you kidding me? You invade somebody's privacy, and the Democratic leadership throws you under a bus. From what we see so far, that was outrageous. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of gender issues, the question isn't who's a man, who's a woman. The question is who's going to fight for women's rights the most. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm sure my opponent would feign outrage and say, what do you mean? I'll fight as hard as anyone. Really? Because when Republicans try to take women's rights away, I don't think I'd be second to anyone in the country in how hard I have fought back throughout my career as a progressive and what I would do today. So, for example, in Ohio, they have a bill that says that if you have a pregnancy that actually attaches in your fallopian tubes, which endangers the life of a woman, that you're supposed to take it out and put the zygote in the uterus, which is scientifically impossible. But they're going to say that anyone who doesn't, both doctors and women, are going to be prosecuted for abortion murder. So I'm sure that my opponent would be opposed to that, of course. I mean, it would be monstrous not to be opposed to that. But what do you do about it? Well, I would do a floor speech in the House and say, the Republicans are monsters and they hate women. They hate women's freedom. They love big government, a government so big it's in your fallopian tubes. And I would embarrass and humiliate them and make sure that you cannot do that to any American on our watch. And so this is part of why I get so frustrated with the establishment Democrats. They got no fight in them. I mean, what are you doing? What an unbelievably terrible bill to propose. And at the national level, sound of silence. I know my opponent. She's establishment through and through. She's going to follow orders from Nancy Pelosi. She's not going to make any of those speeches. She's not. She wants to reach out to Republicans. Are you kidding me? This is the totally wrong-headed ideology of corporate Democrats that, oh, my God, in a purple district, we have to appease Republicans. No, no. Your job as a Democrat is to defeat Republicans, especially when they do things like this to take away women's freedom and to try to control their bodies. But it's true on every issue. The question isn't what gender or ethnicity, et cetera, you are. That's important because it could potentially bring a really important perspective to Congress. But if you're not bringing that perspective and you're not fighting for that perspective, then it defeats the point. The most important thing is to fight on those policy issues so you win for all those groups and you win for all of us.
Mm-hmm. So you bring up the issue of gender. I would imagine that a lot of Current Affairs listeners and readers are huge fans of the Young Turks and of yours. As the race, you know, ramps up, I suspect many people who are familiar with your work are going to be surprised by the stuff that the mainstream media digs up from your past. So I want to raise it with you now and give you the chance to respond. You have some old columns and comments that you've made. In one of them, you write, you know, I had one of the best nights of my life at Mardi Gras. I kissed over 23 women, saw and felt countless breasts, and was in a wonderful drunken stupor, thanks to my friend John Daniels. You say, you know, these were all consensual encounters. In another column, you write that women wouldn't sleep with you because of some sort of genetic deficiency they have, and also elsewhere refer to women as bitches. There's more, you know, that I won't go into. And you've apologized for these columns and pointed out that many of them were written nearly two decades ago. But some of these comments are not that long ago. So, for example, in late 2016, the Young Turks held a panel discussion about the Harvard men's soccer team whose season was canceled after it was discovered that they had produced an annual document rating the attractiveness of incoming freshman women, objectifying them, discussing which sex positions the women liked, and generally commenting on the women's bodies in a vulgar and degrading manner. During the discussion, you disagreed with your co-panelists and seemed to suggest that the only thing the team did wrong was, quote, accidentally somewhat making it public, instead of the publicly available document, quote, I don't even think it's dumb. Do you stand by this assessment?
So you brought up a lot of issues there, Eli, so I got to tackle them one by one.
Sure.
So number one, on the old blogs, look, this is originally found by the right wing. I deleted them 15 years ago, not when I got caught. No one ever caught me on that. I looked at them and on my own without anyone noticing, I thought, these are ugly and I don't believe this at all. So I deleted them. They found them in the Wayback Machine So it's not some sort of convenient conversion at all. And it happened so long ago. The issue is somewhat related to what you're bringing up with Harvard, because is it public or is it not public? Mm-hmm. And so putting them public like that is, again, ugly and insensitive and serves no purpose. Okay. Of course, all the everything was consensual. That would be, I don't even know why you asked that question. It's a weird question to ask. What are you going to just grab women and kiss them without their consent? That doesn't even make any sense. It's important to note here that I'm asked these questions in every single interview. And that is the point of OPPO research. That's why the right wing did it initially, and that's why the corporate Democrats are doing it now. So it takes up valuable time not talking about the issues, because they're terrible on the issues.
Right.
And to try to distract people with personal attacks of something that was said two decades ago. Now, on to the recent story about Harvard. Mm-hmm. Look, and here we could have people disagree, and that's okay, and everybody can vote based on it, and everybody can judge me based on it. But if you say to me, incoming freshman college kids, both male and female, should never talk about the attractiveness of their counterparts in college, I think you're nuts. I think that's the most unrealistic standard I've ever heard in my entire life. And you could say they shouldn't do that, and you could wag your finger at them, but they're going to do it anyway because they're human beings. So the error there, just like I said in the story, is ever making it public. Because when you make it public, then you're demeaning the women publicly, and you are not only being insensitive, but you're opening them up to public derision and all the negative things that come along with that. So if they had purposely made that public, it would be totally, utterly unacceptable. Then you get into a question of, okay, I think most people would say they're allowed to have those thoughts. I think most people would say they're allowed to say those things in private. The question is, should they have ever written them down in a private document? Now we're beginning to split hairs. So if you want to have that discussion or debate, I'm happy to have it. But if you think that no one should be allowed to have those thoughts, it's the most unrealistic thing I've ever heard, both from male and female perspective.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's a good use of our time to litigate the Harvard story, but I guess I just want to follow up and ask, can you understand why, even though you've repudiated some of your older, more egregious columns and comments, people hear about more recent stuff like this and don't fully trust that you've completely evolved on feminism, on women's issues, on fighting patriarchy? I mean, how can they trust you to fight for things like reproductive rights and equal pay?
Yeah, well, okay, so let's talk that through. Mm-hmm. If you watch the Young Turks, and instead of finding one video out of 60,000 where you might have a slight difference, you watched all the videos, or at least some decent percentage of them, you would see that both myself and my co-host Anna Kasparian are ferocious fighters on behalf of women's rights, reproductive rights, on every single issue. By the way, women's rights is not just reproductive rights. We shouldn't put women or any ethnicity into silos. So huge part of women's rights is Medicare for all, making sure that people get health care and treatment that they need, equal pay, and we can go on and on. And we do go on and on for hours on end on the Young Turks. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that we have millions of the most progressive women in the country following us and rooting for us? Because that is exactly what you hear on the Young Turks nonstop. So if someone says, you fighting for women's rights on every state issue, every national issue, and making sure that Republicans never take their freedom away, never treat them as second-class citizens, and that everyone has equal rights, is exactly as our Constitution demands, is not good enough, because I disagreed with you on whether a document was private, public, or if anyone had any thoughts as a freshman in college that they shouldn't have had, okay, then I'm never going to be able to satisfy you. And so have at it, Hoss, find the perfect person, and good luck with that. And by the way, if you do, that person will be so scared of offending anyone that they'll never fight for you. They'll hide in a cave.
On a related note, so you resigned from the Justice Democrats, an organization that you co-founded, after these blog posts you had written years earlier surfaced, and they were described as sexist and racist by the Justice Democrats' leadership, but your resignation came towards the end of 2017. Now, if these blog posts were disqualifying in terms of working for the Justice Democrats in late 2017, why are they not disqualifying now in terms of serving in Congress?
Okay, apparently we are spending a lot of time on this rather than the issues, but yes, I'll address this as well, because I don't have any problem addressing it. I also hope we get to the issues. Okay, so I don't think that the Just Democrats should have taken the action that they did. I was on the board at the time, and I told them it's going to damage the institution more than it's going to damage me. And I'm trying to look out for you guys, because this will be viewed as unfair attacks. You'll be rewarding alt-right figures. I don't want to even name their names. They're so toxic. You'll be rewarding alt-right figures for coming up with blogs from two decades ago. But what's most important is, how does the staff feel about this? Because when you see Just Democrats and you see founders like me and Shoykat Chakrabarty, who wound up being chief of staff for AOC, and Zach Exley and Kyle Kulinski, we're not the important parts. The staff is, because the staff are the folks who found AOC, who helped AOC. Someone like Alexandra Rojas is so important and wonderful. She did field for Just Democrats. I think she's an enormous part of the reason why AOC won the seat that she did. And she's now the executive director of the group. Those are the people who deserve the credit. And so at the time, the staff itself were bothered so much by these blogs. And if you just read those blogs and you think that's what I think today, you should be that bothered by it, right? They were so bothered by it that they said, hey, listen, we need you to step down. So I stepped down. And unfortunately, I think I was right. The public reaction was, guys, this is really unfair. And so I don't know if I can trust Just Democrats anymore. So what did I do in relationship to that? If I was driven by ego, I would have said, ha ha, right? And I would have said, I can't believe this group said these terrible things about me, even though I founded it and I'm against you. But I didn't do that. I did the exact opposite. I said, look, guys, it is the most important thing in the world for these candidates to win. The staff works so hard. It's okay to disagree on this issue, even if it's such an important issue, even if it's personally devastating to me. We have to keep our eyes on the prize. The prize is getting these folks elected so we have strong progressive fighters so that we can pass the bills. If we don't pass the bills, we haven't accomplished anything, okay? Mm-hmm. So I asked the audience to do that. They did do that. They wound up rallying, and we raised $2.5 million for those Just Democrats candidates in the organization. And I think it made all the difference. And I'm super proud of what we did in that regard.
Mm-hmm. So one other thing I wanted to give you the opportunity to respond to, and then I'd like to spend the remainder of the interview discussing your platform. You denied the Armenian genocide in print as a college student and a bit after that as well. What is your stance on the Armenian genocide now, and why did you hold the position that you did?
Yeah, my stance is that it definitely happened. I held a position I did because I grew up as a Turkish American and I only heard one side of the story. Looking back at some of the stuff that I had read back then, let alone written, I'm embarrassed to see how naive I was. You know, some of it was clearly propaganda. And so here, I'll give you one quick example. There was an American colonel named Colonel Chester who wrote back then, the Armenians returned fat and entirely unmassacred. Mm-hmm. How could I possibly believe that? That is so naive. First of all, they did not return. They're not there now. They're just not. Okay, it's not true. Second of all, who would write such a monstrous thing that they returned fat and entirely unmassacred? And as an adult, I look back at that and I go, oh, I know who. Someone was trying to get a contract with the Turkish government and probably had a financial interest. So that's clearly propaganda, but I was too young and naive to understand that. And look, a lot of this stuff ties together. If you say, hey, Cenk, I really don't like, you know, name and age, 20, 25-year-old Cenk, who was a Republican and a bit of a jerk and offensive and didn't understand the context of all of these issues, well, I would agree with you. So, you know, when I see that Winston Churchill quote about, oh, when you're young, you're not a good person if you're not liberal. And then when you're old, you're not a smart person if you're not conservative. I think it's totally wrong. If you live life and you don't become a progressive, there's something wrong with you. And I, not just out of kindness, but out of intelligence. How can you live life and still judge people so harshly and still, you know, categorize people by race or gender and make these distinctions? How can you still see all the evidence in the world and remain a Republican or a conservative? It's astounding to me. So I went through this evolution. And by the way, it helps on the show that I did, because we've now flipped thousands upon thousands of conservatives to becoming progressives, because I come at it from that perspective of, I've been there, I've made the same mistakes you've made, and please be open-minded to the facts and understanding that there's a much better perspective out there.
Okay. Thank you for addressing those controversies. Medicare for All, you back Medicare for All, a single payer healthcare system, correct?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, and if President Sanders brought his Medicare for All bill before Congress, you would support it?
100%.
Okay, and what about the Green New Deal?
You know what, before we move off of that, let me give you a really concrete example.
Please.
So it's not just empty talk, right?
Mm.
So first of all, my establishment opponent, of course, is against Medicare for All. She says she might consider the public option. Wow, mighty generous of her. But look at what's happening in Congress right now. So the current bill that they're considering and debating is about negotiating drug prices. But it's a horrendous bill that's a total Trojan horse. So the Democrats in their election said, oh, drug prices are terrible, right? Everyone said, oh, yeah, that's right, terrible. We're going to lower them for you. Oh, fantastic. We're going to vote for you guys. It was one of the biggest promises that they made. So they come into office, and instead of getting rid of the provision that says that the government cannot negotiate drug prices on behalf of Medicaid and Medicare, which is a preposterous, unbelievable provision that has survived through the Bush, Obama, and Trump eras. It is a definition of crony capitalism. It's a definition of corruption. And it's done purely because both Democrats and Republicans take bribes from the drug companies and extract all of that wealth from us, because our lives literally depend on these drugs. So the Pelosi and leadership come in and say, nope, not all drugs. Okay, all right, well, then 1,000 drugs, right? Or 10,000 drugs. Well, how do you want to limit it? No, only 25 drugs. Are you kidding me? 25 drugs. But wait, it gets worse. All right, fine, progressives. You're complaining a little bit about that. So we'll bring it up to 35 drugs, but we'll make that over a 10-year period. Wait a minute. First of all, that's comical, of course, to get it to 35 drugs 10 years from now. I mean, if the change is going to be this gradual, I mean, in a couple of hundred years, we might finally get the Medicare for All. But it's actually worse than even that, because what it does is then it says it has codified that we are not allowed to negotiate drug prices on all of the other thousands of drugs for another 10 years. Mm-hmm. It's a Trojan horse meant to defeat the idea of the simplest idea, the bare minimum, that of course the government should negotiate prices on your behalf because they're buying the drugs. It's funny thing is, it's actually against capitalism what they're saying. It's against what every country in the world does. And that trick is not brought to you by the Republican Party. To be fair, the Republican Party wouldn't negotiate a single drug price. But that trick is brought to you by the Democratic Party and the corporate Democrats. So not only am I going to fight for Medicare for All, I'm going to fight on every one of these issues. And if I'm on the floor of the House, I'm going to go give speeches that absolutely embarrasses not only the Republican Party, but Democratic leadership, if they're trying to screw over the average voter. Look, if I don't do that, guys, how are we going to move Democratic leadership that is this corporate, that is for such tiny microscopic change, all the way to Medicare for All? We cannot move them unless we move the national conversation. And in order to do that, you need a fighter like me. Look, I got to give you my website, jank2020.com, because millions of dollars are going to pour in against me from drug companies, insurance companies, and every other company that I insult. I do average donation of $28. If I don't have help from actual grassroots supporters, we can't win this race. With that help, we can. Jank is spelled C-E-N-K. And then it's 2020.com, jank2020.com. Thanks.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of quickly run through the gamut of issues and get your stance on them. So you said you support the Green New Deal. Is that correct?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. And what about free college?
Yes.
Okay. Forgiveness of all medical and student debt?
student debt for sure. Medical debt, I have to study a little bit more because that's a complicated issue and it has some degree of nuance. But I'm certainly open to the idea.
Okay. And what about if I have this right, Bernie Sanders rolled out a plan to forgive all existing medical debt, I believe. So do you subscribe to that or?
Yeah, he rolled it out very recently. And so I'm hosting, I'm running the race. I haven't had a chance to read it in detail, but it's okay. A totally good and fair question. So let me get back to you on that.
Yeah. Okay, great. Minimum wage. So California minimum wage already is $15 an hour, right? Do I have that correct?
Yes.
Okay, but
it's transitioning to $15 an hour. They've already passed legislation.
Yeah. Okay, but you would support raising the federal minimum wage as well?
100%.
Okay. Taxes, let's talk about that. Do you support raising taxes, and if so, for whom?
So lots of different categories here. So first of all, I would bring back every one of the Trump tax cuts. Mm-hmm. So some corporate Democrats say, hey, taxes used to be at 35% for corporations, so we should roll them back to 25%. Mm-hmm. What? No, we should roll them back to 35%. They say, well, you know, you got to take out the loopholes. But they didn't take out any loopholes. So, no, I would bring back every dime of those Trump tax cuts. That was $1.9 trillion giveaway to the rich. And I would ask everybody, if I'm on the floor of the House, how are we going to afford that? You see, they ask it about Medicare for All and Green New Deal. They never ask it about when they give giant trillion-dollar tax cuts to the rich. We can't pay for it. We need to bring all of it back. Second of all, capital gains must be taxed at the same rate as ordinary income. For investors to get a weird advantage for not working, it's investment income. No problem. You make the income, you pay the taxes on it. There's no reason in the world you should pay a lower percentage taxes on that than the average American does for working his ass off on his job and making his income and his salary. So those are easy categories. Financial transaction tax, absolutely. And so on Medicare for All, there's this debate about do you raise tax on the middle class. So I've had every analyst you can imagine on the show. And the bottom line is that, yes, taxes would go up for 5% of Americans. So overall costs, I should say, will go up for 5% of Americans, top 5% in income. Mm-hmm. But for the rest of us, the 95%, when you combine taxes and how much money you save from healthcare, you're overall load and the amount that you pay will definitely go down. Mm-hmm. And you'll get much better results as the rest of the world has.
Okay. In terms of issues of war and peace, do you pledge to vote against any military budget increase?
Yes. So look, when it comes to the military budget and any budget, you need nuance by some measure, of course. What are we voting on? Which provisions? So some of these aerospace companies actually are now getting into renewable energy. They want to do more of that. Fantastic. Okay. They do satellites. They do things that are not related to war. But if you're going to give a blank check to someone like Donald Trump, and we were already spending an unbelievable amount of money during the Obama administration, they now increase it by $138 billion. Mm-hmm. And in some categories, even more than the Pentagon requested, obviously outrageous.
Yeah. There's something really incongruous about, you know, all the corporate moderate Democrats who insinuate Donald Trump is this fascist, this, you know, power hungry madman. And yet we ought to continue increasing the military budget and giving him more toys, more war toys to play with.
100%. Eli, it's not just Republicans and the mainstream media and the corporate Democrats that are hypocritical on this. Mm. There's a small faction of progressives who believe Donald Trump when he said he wanted to get out of the Middle East and end the endless wars. Are we done with that yet? Because we all really ought to be, because he has not decreased the wars at all. No. He's greatly increased the Pentagon budget. Yes. All he's done is move troops around, and he put troops back into Saudi Arabia. It's disaster on top of disaster. It's literally his 12,000th lie. And he wants to do no such thing. He is a total tool of his donors on this issue as well as all the others.
Mm-hmm. So do you support ending the wars in Yemen, Afghanistan, Iraq, and Syria? And if so, what steps in Congress will you take to advance those goals?
absolutely support that. We need to do a smart withdrawal. That does not mean that we do it overnight like Donald Trump did in northern Syria. By the way, he withdrew from northern Syria for God knows what financial deal he did with Turkey. I don't want anybody to be under the misimpression that he took troops out of Syria. He just moved them to a different part of Syria. Mm-hmm. So that is both not a withdrawal and way too abrupt with no planning at all. Mm-hmm. It's preposterous. On the other hand, I'm not going to fall into the trap, the neocon trap of, oh, good, smart withdrawal. So let's do it over the course of the next 8 years. Mm-hmm. No way. It's going to be a real withdrawal. It's going to be smart, deliberate, but quick. Mm-hmm. Okay, it has to have a realistic timeline that gets us out of there as soon as possible and brings our troops back home and keeps them safe and not in these wars of aggression. The mm-hmm. probably the best congressperson on this by a lot is Ro Khanna. Mm-hmm. Ro has been fighting to end these wars for so long, and I would back him 100% on that.
Mm-hmm. And he has endorsed you.
Yes. Ro was also the first person to ever come out. Even though he was already an incumbent and he knew he was going to get a lot of heat from the establishment Democrats, he came out on the Young Turks and said, I declare myself a Justice Democrat. Mm-hmm. Before AOC had won, anybody else had won. He's a legislator who's really progressive and with tremendous courage.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about an issue which has seemingly fallen off the map, and you'd be lucky to hear this word cross any congressperson's lips. Guantanamo Bay. At this point, there's a de facto bipartisan consensus among politicians on Guantanamo Bay in favor of keeping it open indefinitely, de facto. Do you support closing Guantanamo and releasing all the detainees or bringing charges against them? Will you bring pressure to bear to make this happen? For example, resolution or threatening to not fund something if the president doesn't act on this issue. Not that the United States has a real wonderful human rights record, but it's just such, it's one of the worst crimes of the 21st century, Guantanamo Bay and what we've done there. So thoughts on that?
I'm glad you brought that up. Every once in a while, Guantanamo Bay pops into my head and I think, my God, are we still keeping those people over there?
Right.
How outrageous is that? So let's also break this down. First of all, no one should be in Guantanamo Bay. It is an area that was set up to be lawless. It isn't about the detainees. It's about us. Who are we? Are we a country of laws? Do we believe in human rights? Do we believe in literally the infrastructure of democracy? This goes back to all the way to the Magna Carta. You must show people in front of a judge. Habeas corpus, it's really the foundation of our government at its core. So the detainees are important, but what it says about us as Americans is even more important. So we've got to get everyone out of Guantanamo Bay. The question is, where do you put them? So there are different categories there. If someone has been adjudicated guilty of a crime or of terrorism, well, then you bring them to America and you tried them like we did with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. If the Republicans say we can't do that, it's a grave insult to our justice system. Are you mm-hmm. saying that, they will say we have the best justice system in the world and then they'll say, oh my God, it's so weak that it can't even try and charge and convict terrorists. Really, that makes no sense at all. Okay, and then there is a category of folks that are somewhere in the middle. Well, then if they're in the middle, why are you keeping them there without trial for decades now? And then there are the category of people who we have deemed are actually innocent. They didn't do it. They got thrown in there because somebody wanted to collect a $5,000 ransom or plenty of other reasons why they were thrown in there. Well, if they're innocent, if you're not releasing them and you're keeping somebody prisoner for decades when you know they're innocent, mm-hmm. A, that's obviously a horrible thing to do. And B, again, what does it say about you? That you would be willing to do that to innocent people, what, for your own political benefit, for your political career, because you didn't want to take slight more risk on that? Totally outrageous. Mm-hmm. So, yes, I'll fight on that issue as well.
Wonderful. And what are your thoughts on indefinite detention? I don't know if you saw Spencer Ackerman's article that came out around Thanksgiving in the Daily Beast about how Donald Trump was using this obscure provision within the Patriot Act to indefinitely detain a man whose major crime was writing some checks to organizations that the United States had deemed terroristic in nature. And because we can't deport the man, he served his time at this point, but because we can't deport the man to a country, we are indefinitely detaining him. What are your thoughts on detaining American citizens and non-citizens indefinitely?
So I have to confess that I don't know the particulars of that case, but I'll tell you as a general matter that there is no such thing as indefinite detention in the U.S. Constitution or in the American legal system. So I don't know what they rely on. I don't know how any judge that's ever gone through law school can agree to an indefinite detention after someone has served their sentence. On what grounds, both legally or constitutionally? Mm-hmm. The main question here, and it also relates to what's happening in the news today in regards to impeachment. Are we going to follow our laws or aren't we? So, because if you don't, then you have full-blown fascism. Then might makes right. Laws don't mean anything. Justice doesn't mean anything. Due process doesn't mean anything. Then whoever's stronger and whoever can use weapons, the military, or force more will win. Well, that's fascism. I believe in rule of law. I believe in the American system of government.
Mm-hmm. On the issue of money in politics, I know that this is an issue that's near and dear to your heart. You're refusing to take contributions from big dollar donors and corporate PAC money, correct?
Yes.
Okay. And if you could talk a bit about your prior work around this issue, like with Wolfpack, and if elected, what you intend to do to get money out of politics or big money out of politics.
So this is both the biggest issue and the biggest contrast between me and my corporate Democratic opponent. Now, sometimes people get feel offended if I say corporate Democrats. Well, in the state of California, she is an assemblywoman, and you could actually take direct corporate contributions, not even PACs, not even lobbyists, just corporations come and buy you. Okay. And then when I say that, the corporate Democrats get outraged. What do you mean? Just because a corporation gave me several thousand dollars, you think they did that because they wanted to influence me rather than doing it out of charity? Yeah, that's what I think. And that's what every single voter thinks. Mm-hmm. So it's not offensive that I point that out. It's offensive that you do it. So she's, for example, taken thousands of dollars directly from insurance companies. Gee, I wonder why she's against Medicare for All. I can't quite figure it out. So how do we fix this? Again, I don't believe in incrementalism. So if you follow the Pelosi method on this, a couple of centuries from now, we begin to get to solutions. No, we don't have that kind of time. And besides which, the window closes on you. The more corporate power consolidates itself, the more we become a different country. Our politicians become more and more corrupt. Our government becomes less democratic. We must act right now. We must have the fierce urgency of now. So, and small solutions are not the right answer here. The correct answer is a constitutional amendment. And there is a logical and practical and pragmatic reason for that. If you pass bills, the Supreme Court can just come in their infinite corruption and go, no, I think corporations are human beings, and I think they have speech rights, and how dare you try to limit my friends in the corporate world? And they can strike down any bill.
I wanted to ask you about that. Now, what are your thoughts on the ACLU position that Citizens United was properly decided on First Amendment grounds?
Well, I have debated that with different folks in the ACLU. And I can tell you, knowing the folks at the ACLU, that there is great internal division within the organization on that. There's a couple of people at the top who refuse to budge, but a huge portion of the ACLU thinks that was one of the worst things they've ever come out on and wants the organization to change their point of view on that. Because corporations are not human beings. To try to protect their so-called civil rights is preposterous. It's an insult to everyone who's ever worked in civil rights.
But you don't reject that more money means more speech and less money means less speech, right?
No, I do reject that because it depends on what you mean by more money and more speech. So, for example, if more money could mean Sheldon Adelson putting in $50 million into a campaign, which he has from time to time, or name your person, Koch Brothers, it doesn't matter, right? Or ExxonMobil or the NRA. But let's, for now, let's stick with Sheldon Adelson. Mm-hmm. He says, well, you see, I spent more money. There was more speech. No, there was speech from only one person, and that $50 million drowned out the speech of everyone else, thousands, perhaps millions of other people.
Yeah.
So his more money did not necessarily equal more speech at all. It bought him a larger megaphone.
Right, but more speech for him. Exactly. So you do agree then, right?
No, it gives him more power. It allows him to buy more ads. It allows him to deceive more people.
Right.
I don't concede that that is a net positive in any way, shape, or form.
But that's not the question.
Either legally or constitutionally.
Yeah, but the question is not whether it's a net positive if Sheldon Adelson had more money to spend on the elections. The question is his spending money to promote his viewpoint speech? And it sounds like you think it is.
Not necessarily, because sometimes money could be speech. So, for example, if he wanted to buy a half an hour of airtime to give all of his views on the different issues, yes, then it could translate into speech or more speech, right? I think Congressman Jamie Raskin made this point in Congress, a great point. If money just equaled speech, when you give money to a sex worker, I guess you'd just be talking to them. Well, everybody knows, no, in that case, money means something else entirely. So just equating money and speech is not a logical position. So let alone all the other maladies that come with that. So look, if anyone, including a few holdouts of the ACLU, want to argue that corporations are just as human as the rest of us and they, poor guys, they really, really need more speech. And you know, we should drown out the speech of all other citizens to make them happy. Okay, they can make that position, but I'll maul them on that. In fact, I had a debate with one of the top First Amendment lawyers in the country, Floyd Abrams, at Oxford. They invited us. They were very wonderful to invite us, and we had a debate. And Floyd's, I'm sure, smarter than I am, and one of the top experts in the field, so I'm sure more of an expert than I am. And I beat him 2-1. I beat him easily. Why? Because I'm better? No. Because this is the most obvious question in the world.
Well, I don't know about that. We could go back and forth on this for a while, I'm sure, but I don't want to dwell on it too much longer because I want to try and squeeze in a few more questions. You support the public funding of elections? Like publicly funded
100%.
Elections? 100%.
Okay. To connect those two things.
Yeah.
Look, if you don't end the private financing of elections, our politicians will forever work for private interest. Uh-huh. If you do public financing of elections, you save a tremendous amount of money, and then our legislators can work for the public interest. And you must do that with an amendment, otherwise the Supreme Court is going to strike it down. They have already declared that they are corrupt and work for corporations. You must do an amendment, and actually doing an amendment is easier and more practical than people realize. And so please check out Wolfpack if you haven't, because they're in the middle of doing that. You should help them do that, in my opinion.
Thank you for that. Mm-hmm. Okay. Speaking of First Amendment and free speech, one of the greatest threats to free speech and the First Amendment in the U.S. is around criticizing Israel. This is speech which has been published and criminalized in all sorts of ways. If elected as a member of Congress, will you oppose any bills or resolutions which in any way criminalize, punish, or adversely affect critics of Israel for First Amendment protected activities?
Yes. I think the conservatives are massive hypocrites on this. They say, oh my God, I've got to have free speech rights to yell racist things on college campuses. By the way, it's not really free speech. They get paid by right-wing billionaires for those speeches. They get paid an outrageous sum for that. But they say, oh, I have to have my freedom of speech to say all these hateful things. And then they turn around and say, hey, you're not allowed to criticize Israel. And if you do, we'll lock you up. They never meant free speech. They just meant, I want to be able to say racist things.
On a related note, Bernie Sanders has talked about this, as has AOC. Would you pledge to cut military aid to Israel and leverage it until they comply with international law?
Yes. So the settlements are illegal and immoral, and it does not help Israel to aid and abet extremist right-wing governments in Israel. Because all it does is lead to more war, more terrorism, more instability, not just for the Palestinians, but also for the Israelis. If you care about Israel and you care about the Palestinians, and any decent person should care about both, then you would want peace, a just peace that includes ending the settlements, and in my opinion, a two-state solution.
Mm-hmm. On the issue of immigration, do you support abolishing ICE, CBP, and/or DHS?
So that's another issue that is nuanced, and what it requires is us to do is restructure those organizations so they stop their Gestapo tactics, like putting kids in cages, separating families, doing unnecessary raids, the deportations that are not based on criminal actions. Mm-hmm. So I support all the substance of those efforts. What you call the different agencies to me is a lot less relevant.
Do you support guaranteed legal representation for anyone involved in deportation proceedings, anyone facing deportation?
Well, if we don't do that, we're not America. So yes, any human being that is under the jurisdiction of the United States of America should have at a minimum a basic due process that they are accorded by law.
When you say basic due process, that doesn't mean a lawyer. So that's what I'm asking. Do you support guaranteed legal representation for anyone involved in deportation proceedings?
Yeah, I think due process does mean a lawyer.
Okay.
So I remember when Attorney General Holder said when we were executing U.S. citizens with drone strikes abroad,
right,
that due process does not necessarily mean judicial review. He's 100%
right,
wrong about that.
Okay. Do you support ending expedited removal?
I'd have to look at the details of what folks mean by expedited removal. But I think that but I'll be clear. I think if someone has committed a crime here and they're undocumented, I do believe they should be deported. But if I don't believe
any
in
crime?
Rounding up people.
Any crime?
No, there has to be a threshold. There has to be a threshold. I think felony is probably a logical threshold. But we'd have to look into the details of that to make a good informed decision.
Uh-huh.
But if they haven't committed a crime, we need to do a pathway to citizenship.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that are currently proposed that didn't even pass provide a pathway to citizenship that is far, far too long.
Mm-hmm. Do you support decriminalizing immigration offenses? Like, should it be criminal to cross the border?
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. And I think Julian Castro has made really interesting points about this.
Mm-hmm.
Those points are relatively new, and I would need to study that a little bit more, because I understand that making it a civil offense, for example, is a viable alternative.
Hmm.
In terms of what degree of criminality, that's an interesting question. And so I'd have to study that one more to see where I land on it.
But you know that our criminal justice system is a deeply racist, dehumanizing, inhumane system. So why should we put more people into it? I mean, it's already this elephantine, huge thing. We don't need more people pushed into the purview of the criminal justice system. Do you disagree?
Well, no, it depends, though, Eli. So we need a criminal justice system. So if someone is charged with serious crimes, murder, rape, et cetera, well, they're going to have to go in the criminal justice system. That doesn't mean that we shouldn't make every effort to make the criminal justice system more just. And there's a lot of efforts there that I support, including ending bail cash, and I could go on. But we certainly need a criminal justice system. And it's a fair question as to whether people crossing the border without documents should be in that system or in the civil system. And what I'm telling you is I need to study that more to see where I come out on it. But I applaud Secretary Castro for bringing that up as an issue that we should all think more about.
Okay. You mentioned the criminal justice system. What issues that we haven't covered already are important to your district, and what will you be doing to address them? If you want to talk further about the criminal justice system, because we haven't really gotten into it, you're welcome. I know gun violence is another issue affecting your district, but if there's anything else.
So I know you cover national issues, so we haven't talked much about my district, and we're short on time here, but let me try to address those questions as quickly as I can. There's a lot to do in the criminal justice system. First and foremost is end the war on drugs. So not only should marijuana be legalized, but we need to get nonviolent offenders out of prison. They've been sitting there for decades in a horribly unjust and, yes, racist system rigged against them. And guys like Joe Biden saying that he might look at moving marijuana off of Schedule One. Wow. Again, a couple hundred years from now, we might finally do something that's smart and logical and fair. No, not good enough. It should be legalized at the federal level, and we should stop imprisoning our fellow Americans completely unjustly. Now, that leads to private prisons. I would vote to abolish all of them, period. It's not a close question. You cannot create a profit motive to take away the freedom of American citizens or anyone else.
Let me just
It's an absolute
really
outrage.
What about private detention centers, which are holding people, undocumented people, or, yeah, in this country? Private detention centers as well?
Yes.
Okay.
I would, because that is a core government function. If you outsource a core government function and put a profit motive on it, it then drives an incentive for corporations to take away people's freedom. And that's totally unacceptable. Mm-hmm. There's so many reforms that need to be done in the criminal justice system that it's hard to cover it in the amount of time that
I
think that people, no, that's okay. The prosecutors like Krasner in Philadelphia are doing great work in beginning that reform process. And so I support that. And in terms of gun rights and gun control, you know, we have the shooting in Saugus High School in my district. And again, my opponent puts out a set message saying thoughts and prayers. That means I'm not going to do anything about it. I'm too scared of Republicans. And this district is too purple. And there's too many police officers that live in this district that I'm not going to take any action. That's decoding the politics of that statement. I don't agree with that at all. And it goes back to the core issue that everything comes back to. 97% of Americans want a federal background check. Do we really live in a democracy if we can't pass a law that 97% of Americans want? No, that means that the system is fundamentally corrupt. Mitch McConnell will not allow a vote on that because he's taken $1.2 million in bribes from the NRA. And if you don't address that and you don't tackle that head on, we will never get effective gun control in this country. We will have mass shootings everywhere, including everyone who's listening to this. Please, please do not be surprised. It is going to happen in your area. It's already happened in my area several times. And it'll continue to happen as long as gun manufacturers profit off of our deaths and they buy Republican politicians to enable that. So the only solution is to get money out of politics. If you don't get money out of politics, we're dooming this country to an undemocratic, un-American form of government. And we're also dooming ourselves and our, in this case, our kids to significantly greater dangers. And I can't abide by that. And that's exactly why I'm running.
Okay. One final question. One thing that I find very exciting about your campaign is that you have a really refreshing and inspiring political vision. So in your interview with Anna Kasparian, where you announced your congressional bid, you discussed how if you were elected, you would work with other progressive challengers to unseat anyone, including moderate and corporate Democrats, who oppose a progressive agenda at every turn. I was hoping that you would discuss your political strategy a bit more, and if elected, what role you see yourself playing in Congress.
Yeah. First of all, I would love for any of my Democratic opponents to go through an interview like this. It would be a wonderfully comical thing to listen to. Every answer would be no, 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 no. But they don't do media like this because they don't want to answer questions. Okay. Anyway, so I, on the other hand, love that question. Look, we are not, if I get elected, did we win? No, we didn't win anything. If Bernie Sanders gets elected, did we win? No, we didn't really win anything. No, winning is passing bills that affect your lives. If we haven't done that, we haven't accomplished anything at all. Who cares if someone calls me a congressman or even if they call Bernie Sanders president? Yes, that's going to feel great, but that's not the end goal. Okay, the end goal is to pass legislation so that we improve your lives. So in order to do that, you've got to do carrots and sticks. softball and hardball. And Democratic Party does do hardball. They do have sticks, to be fair to them. They are reserved for progressives. So they have come out in their fury against me. They've done every Oppo research, every personal attack, every character assassination. I wish they would use that every once in a while on a Republican, but almost never, never do they do it to a Republican. So, and the reason why is because they have the same donors. This is all a shell game that they're playing on the American voters. Mm-hmm. So am I going to call that out? Damn straight I am. And am I going to work to bring more progressives in the Congress? Yes, because if we don't have more progressives, we can't pass the bills. So if they say to me, but yes, but Cenk, you're offending your Democratic colleague who's taking millions of dollars from corporations, and, you know, shouldn't you be nice to your colleague? No, I have no obligation to my so-called colleague. I have an obligation to my voters. The job title is representative. My job is to represent my voters. It is not to represent my corrupt corporate colleagues. Mm-hmm. So yes, I will work against them. But look, I don't. If I had my druthers, what would happen is we would win enough. The first wave was the Just Democrats. They came in 2018. Since I'm a special election, I can arguably be a one-man second wave. Third wave is the next round of Just Democrats coming in 2020. You don't have to unseat all of the conservative Democrats. Mm-hmm. You just have to show them a credible threat of losing the one thing they care most about, their power and privilege. And if you do that effectively, they will then turn around and say, well, of course, I didn't mean corporate back money. Lobbyists, oh my God, I can't stand lobbyists. And they'll start to vote in our direction. If they do that, then I don't care at all that they have that power and privilege. Sure, keep it. What do I care? It's not personal. All I want to do is pass the bills.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, on that note, this is a very exciting race. Thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. How can people stay up to date with the campaign, volunteer, donate, and support you?
Absolutely. So Cenk2020.com, that's C-E-N-K. I know it's confusing. I'm an immigrant. C-E-N-K2020.com. And so, first of all, look, small dollar donations, or as large as you can make them, of course, make all the difference, because we don't need to outraise her. And that's going to be near impossible with all the defense contractors and the insurance companies and the Democratic Party. They're going to spend untold millions of dollars to prevent me from calling them out. But we do need to get to a minimum. If we get to a minimum, just like AOC did, they're in a world of trouble. So please help in that direction. I have no one but you guys to do that. So far, we've gotten 16,000 individual contributions, which is unprecedented, and it's got them running scared, which I love. They're supposed to be scared of the voters. So you guys are supposed to be in charge in a democracy. And the second part of that is, if you're anywhere near the 25th district, Palmdale, Lancaster, Santa Clarita, Simi Valley, in the LA area, please come and volunteer. In fact, you could volunteer to do phone banking anywhere. You don't have to be near there. It's great if you can come and do canvassing and knock on doors with us. I go and join the canvassers, so we do it together. I sometimes join the phone bank, so we do that together. If we can reach the voters with our message, we will win. And we could do that through both the funding, but also through volunteering. And God help them if we tell the voters that there's someone who will actually stand up for them and not for the corporations, who will actually serve them rather than the donors, because then our chances of winning skyrocket. So it's completely in our hands. If you guys give and volunteer, we will win this race. We will shock the country, and you'll have as big a progressive fighter as there's been in a long time in the middle of the House of Representatives. And that's our house, and you could help take it back. So Cenk2020.com.
Well, thanks again for joining us. Thanks for tuning in, Current Affairs listeners. Until next time.